this being way before the days of social media. People weren't shopping online the way they are today, so a lot of his orders were telephone-based. And that's the reason Kevin came up with that funky old English spelling of the word armor in his company name. When he was applying for a toll-free number, 888-4-A-R-M-O-U-R was available, so he hit on that. "This is how naive I was at the time," he says. "I thought, who knows how long this internet thing will last, but I have this cool toll-free number so people will be able to find us." On a lot of the first designs, Kevin even put that phone number on the back of the shirt, along with his web address, a collector's item now if you could find one in the back of your closet. Tough it out. Now, I don't mean to race over those first couple years, because like a lot of guys who start out running businesses out of their grandmother's row house, Kevin hit a couple of bumps along the way. That first $16,000, I spent in about 5 minutes, he says. Success doesn't usually find you on your own schedule, and it hardly ever happens as fast as you want it to happen. Sometimes you have to wait for it, but a hard charger like Kevin didn't have it in him to wait. "I can still remember this one day," he says. "It was a Friday afternoon, and I went to the bank, and I took out the $3,400 I had left in my account. I had $6,000 in checks I had to cover, and I didn't know what to do. So I got the idea that I would head to Atlantic City. It was right up Route 40. I would take that $3,400 and hit the blackjack tables." Wasn't exactly a sound business strategy, but when you're up against it, you're up against it. You'll try anything to keep your idea alive. So that's just what Kevin did, and for a while, it looked like his gamble would pay off. The cards were with him when he started out. He turned that $3,400 into $4,000, turned that $4,000 into $5,000. His stack was getting close to $6,000. He could smell it, taste it, started to think he could run it all the way up to $10,000. But then, poof, it was gone. All of it. "I don't know if you've ever been broke," he says, telling me this story. "Flat broke, broke broke. But you don't know what broke is until you pull up to the Delaware Memorial Bridge and have to face that $2 toll just to get home. It was the single worst moment of my life, having to face that poor toll booth operator waiting for her $2. I was so broke, I couldn't even check for loose change in the ashtray and the seat cushions. I'm talking can't even stop for a soda broke." He gassed up the car on the way into Atlantic City, but other than that, Kevin was on empty. All he could do was throw up his hands and beg for mercy, say, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but I just don't have the money." The woman stepped out of her toll booth and flashed him this scolding, pitiful look, like he was the lowest of the low. Then she took down his license plate number, his registration number, started writing him a summons. He never been more embarrassed. He didn't even have $2 to his name, all because he'd gambled away the last of his cash at the blackjack table. He ended up driving to his mother's house, which was right by the post office where he'd set up a P.O. box. He figured he could check the mail and stop in for dinner, since he didn't have any money for food anyway. His mother asked how things were going with the company, and Kevin gave her the same answer he always gave. He said, "It's going great, Mom. We're doing fine." Underneath, though, he was thinking, "I'm totally screwed. I just made the biggest mistake of my life." For the first time he could remember, he cried. He couldn't think of a way out. After dinner, he went to the post office, and there in the Under Armour box was a check for $7,500 from Georgia Tech University, one of the first school accounts he opened. He'd been chasing the athletic director for months for payment, and the check just happened to arrive in the middle of this low, low moment and left Kevin thinking maybe he'd be okay after all. Be famous for something. One of the reasons Kevin was able to grow Under Armour into such a monster global brand was because he never strayed from his commitment to his core concept. "We became famous for making the world's greatest t-shirt for when it's warm outside," he says. "That's how we became known. And that's what I tell people all the time when they're just starting out. Be famous for something." We were famous for our performance t-shirt, which was unlike anything on the market at the time. After that, We set out to make the world's greatest t-shirt for when it's cold outside. So then we became known for that too. It doesn't matter if you're playing football or bow hunting or playing tennis or skiing, we've got you covered. As I write this, Under Armour has posted its 20th consecutive quarter of 20% growth or more, one of only two companies in the S&P 500 that can make this claim. And Kevin still runs the business like a football team. Sales and marketing, those guys are on offense. Manufacturing, distribution, that's defense. Kevin himself was a special teams guy in college, so that's become his role. He's in the middle of everything. The company's got over 10,000 employees all over the world, but at the headquarters office in Baltimore, you can find these whiteboards in Kevin's office. Kevin writes all these sayings and slogans on the board, words and phrases to inspire his team. His latest, no loser talk. He says, everywhere you go, you hear people talk about how the world is falling apart. Everybody is an expert. But at Under Armour, I want our people to control what they can control. Leave the pontificating to everyone else. Leave all that negative talk to everyone else. He's got a whole bunch of them. Dictate the tempo. Walk with a purpose. Protect this house. That's one of his favorites. And to hear Kevin tell it, a phrase like this, it helps to foster a certain pride of ownership, a sense of teamwork. We're very much a lean forward organization, he says. We're all about what we can do, not what we cannot do. To illustrate, he points back to those first few months after he graduated from college, running through his $16,000 investment. There were naysayers all around, people telling him he needed more money to launch a business, people telling him he didn't know anybody in the sports apparel business, in the fashion business, in retail. I didn't have any of that experience or any of those contacts, he admits. But what I did have was this network of 30, 40, 50 guys I could reach out to and say, hey, can I just get you to try something? You can tell me I didn't know anybody in a traditional business sense, but that just didn't apply in this case. I refused to let it apply because everybody knows somebody, right? Really, it drives Kevin up the wall when he hears someone on his team talk about how well the company is doing in spite of this or considering that. He doesn't want to hear it, so he reminds his team that the same way a rising tide lifts all boats, you have to be prepared for when the tide goes out. He says being the tallest short guy in the room can still be a pretty good thing.
Kevin's key shark point, keep swimming. Those bumps Kevin hit when he was just starting out, they didn't stop him from chasing this one idea. They didn't even slow him down. Whatever he had to do, he found a way to get it done. He even sat himself down in front of a sewing machine. He didn't have a clue on how to sew, but he figured it out because he had no choice but to figure it out. He tells people looking to start their own businesses that they have to be prepared to change, adapt, and grow. To learn every aspect of the business from the ground up, inside out, top to bottom. Yep, you know what I'm talking about. All of that. You've got to evolve, he says. If you try one thing and it's just not working, figure out why it's not working and address it. There are too many entrepreneurs sitting in their attics and basements right now saying, it's just not right, or it's just not ready. But you've got to make it right. You've got to make it ready. Push yourself where you need to be. What do you really want out of life? That's the question that drives Kev. And for him, just because he obviously used to play football, I'm going to use a football metaphor. The goal line keeps moving. First, it was starting a business. Then it was reaching a certain number in sales. Then a certain number after that. And all along, he just kept driving, pushing. Listen, my man Kev is such a hard charger that he makes me feel like I'm actually a loser who hasn't accomplished anything in life. I leave his office after talking to him, and I just have to go out there and do some push-ups. So keep doing those push-ups. I'm talking to you. Stay sharp. Keep at it. And when you hit your first target, go ahead and pick out another one and another one after that.
4. What it is. Okay, so by now you've had a chance to meet some motivated entrepreneurs, each with a power broke type story to tell. Hopefully, you found a couple takeaways from their stories you can attach to your own. Maybe learn from some of their mistakes and some of their successes. I've also shared a few Shark Tank pitches and a couple glimpses behind the scenes at FUBU to show you how broke can make you in business and how it can break you. And we've talked a little bit about what it means to have to struggle when you're just starting out. But let's not forget, there's all kinds of broke. Sometimes you can have all the money in the world, but you might be disadvantaged in some other way. Maybe you're a minority looking to open up a business in a mostly white community. Maybe you're a woman looking to get things going in a male-dominated industry. Maybe you're a young upstart brand like Under Armour looking to play on the same field with big-budget mega brands like Nike and Adidas. Maybe you're dyslexic and you've been able to slog your way through school, but out in the real world, it's becoming harder and harder for you to process all the material you need to take in if you want to get and keep an edge in your career.
Power fact. Dyslexia is far more common amongst entrepreneurs than it is amongst executives in traditional corporate settings, both in the United States and the United Kingdom. Now, this is a crazy stat, but you can see these trends across the board. More than 35% of U.S. entrepreneurs have dyslexic traits, which tells us that folks like me are more comfortable in a startup environment. That's where we can actually do things our own way.
Let me just finish up on this dyslexia piece, because I've been working to shine some light on this issue for young people today. I've spoken about my own struggles with dyslexia at the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity and worked with the folks at www.understood.org to develop programming and tools to help dyslexic students achieve in the classroom. Who knew you could get into Yale by not reading? I'm just saying. But what most people don't realize is that being dyslexic is a little like being broke. There can be a silver lining to it. A disability of any kind forces you to compensate. If you're blind, you develop a better sense of smell, that sort of thing. In my case, reading was always difficult for me. I struggled in school, not because I wasn't smart, but because I took in information in a different way, at a different speed. After a while, I figured out all these ways to compensate, different ways to learn. I had to work harder, smarter, more efficiently, more creatively, just to keep up with everybody else. For a long time, being dyslexic wasn't the kind of thing you talked about. When I was a kid, nobody even thought to get me diagnosed, to see what might have been holding me back. And now that I've found a level of success running my own companies, building all these brands, I've come to look on being dyslexic as a kind of asset. Why? Because it forces me to think things through, to assess the situation from all sides, to take my time until a solution becomes clear. These days, all these different learning disabilities, they're all the way out in the open. And what we're finding as my generation comes of age and starts to make all this noise in the world is that we're not alone. Winston Churchill, George Bush, Benjamin Franklin, all these great leaders were dyslexic. Whoopi Goldberg, Jay Leno, George Burns, all these great comic minds also dyslexic. Great inventors and thinkers like Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, dyslexic. Henry Ford, Richard Branson, Walt Disney, you get the idea. Oh, and as long as we're keeping score, four out of my six fellow sharks on Shark Tank also struggle with dyslexia. I'm not telling tales away from the set here, because they've all spoken publicly about it. But see if you can guess who's with me on this. Here's a not-so-subtle hint. Barbara is definitely one of us. Point is, there's always something standing in your way. For a lot of us, it's money. But it doesn't end there. There's always a hassle, a struggle. If starting a business was easy, we'd all be moguls, right? If making a fortune and a name for ourselves was such a no-brainer, we'd all be rich and famous. If becoming the best in the world at what we do was a cakewalk, we'd all be Olympic gold medalists and best-selling authors and industry leaders. But that's not how it goes. No. How it goes is that success finds us when we find a way to deal with the stuff that gets in our way. We don't run from it. We don't ignore it. We power past it, make the best of it, look for other ways to make some noise on our own. In each case, successful folks who've had to deal with any kind of disability are a lot like the entrepreneurs we've been reading about. They've had to find their own way to push themselves to make up whatever ground they might have been losing. Basically, they had to figure it out. The power of broke at its best. Get there anyway, or get there anyway. Now let's get back to the idea of disadvantage in general. The idea that being broken forces you to take a different path to the same goal, to find another way. So what are those other ways? Well, in my own career, the edge has come from pushing myself to think creatively. Early on, it was about making sure the money I did have to invest in my business was spent wisely, powerfully. One way we did that at FUBU was to get our shirts on the backs of some of the background dancers as music videos really started to pop. Sometimes if we played it right and got lucky, we'd get the artists themselves to wear our clothes. That move got us a lot of play. We must have had a dozen shirts in circulation, and we'd run around the city from set to set trying to persuade these up-and-coming performers to wear our clothes in their videos. Always, we were careful to seek out performers we felt a deep connection to. Someone from our neighborhood, like LL Cool J, who for some reason even let me jump into the shot on one of his videos. We couldn't afford to actually give these artists the shirts, but we'd have a couple of styles to choose from, in a couple of sizes, and hope like crazy they'd grab one of our hockey jerseys or a t-shirt and pump up the FUBU name on camera. Remember my buddy Kevin Plank, the CEO of Under Armour, who you met in the last chapter? Turned out, we each got one of these product placement pushes in the same movie. That movie was the great football flick, Any Given Sunday, directed by Oliver Stone and starring Al Pacino, Cameron Diaz, and a dynamite cast of others. My boy LL was in that movie. It was one of his first big starring roles, and he decided to wear one of our tie-dye football jerseys in the music video from the soundtrack. Yeah, I know it looks kind of hideous now, but back in 1999, we all thought it was pretty sweet. Our FUBU line had been stumbling a little bit, but then LL turns up in the video with this ugly jersey, and in the movie itself in a skull cap with our logo on it, and it totally reinvigorated the brand. It was night and day. At the same time, Kevin had a bunch of friends from his football playing days who were working as extras in the movie, so he got the name of the costume designer on the set and sent over a bunch of shirts. A couple days later, he got a call from Oliver Stone's office wanting to see some samples. They loved Under Armour's futuristic modern look. It fit with the tone and tempo of the piece. So when that movie came out, the exposure gave both our brands a shot in the arm, the kind of publicity we never could have bought on our own. But here's the thing. Over at FUBU, the Hollywood play only pushed us back to where we'd already been. Gotta be honest, it pumped us up, but only in a small way, only for a short while. Before Any Given Sunday, at our peak, we'd been a $200 million brand. Lately, we'd seen those numbers dip, but once the movie and the soundtrack video came out, we shot all the way back up to about the $200 million level right where we'd been before. The product placement in this film was the spark that fueled the Under Armour fire. It provided the lift and awareness that Kevin needed to be able to drive the brand forward, eventually growing Under Armour into the $3 billion company that it is today. What's the takeaway here? Over at FUBU, I guess we got a little fat and lazy. The power of broke was no longer running through our veins the way it was when we were just starting out. That urgency we all felt back when we were broke and starting out? Gone. But over at Under Armour, they were still lean and hungry. There was still a sense of urgency you tend to find in a startup environment. The power of broke? They were still feeling it in a big time way. It just goes to show that the breaks that you find when you're hungry and cranking can sometimes make the biggest difference. Look under the covers and off to the side. That Any Given Sunday plug was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Just kind of fell our way. But those music videos were our bread and butter. Trouble was, the approach only worked for a while. Eventually, these artists got too big, started surrounding themselves with wardrobe people and stylists and managers who were smart enough to treat these type of product placements as a business transaction. When you're first in on a trend or strategy, you only have the field to yourself for a short while. So before long, we had to start looking for other ways to promote our brand. A natural extension of our music video push was to get on a channel where these music videos lived. At the time, the BET network was the go-to place for our community. It was our own little safe haven on the dial. Back in 1998, it felt to us like every black kid in America was watching BET, from New York to Detroit to Los Angeles, and everywhere in between. A 30-second commercial spot on BET ran about $1,500, which was a ridiculous bargain. Just to give a comparison, a 30-second spot on Friends, one of the top-rated primetime shows that season, cost $422,000. One of the reasons the BET rates were so low was because the AC Nielsen Company, the folks who measured viewership for the networks and affiliate stations, tended not to put their famous boxes in predominantly black communities. I don't know why this was the case, but it definitely was. As a result, the Nielsen ratings for BET programs didn't really reflect the actual ratings, so the advertising was cheap. You got a whole lot of bang for your buck. And when you're broke, that's the right kind of equation. You wouldn't know this unless you knew the market, but we had our eyes open and our ears to the ground. We knew BET shows were watched and talked about, and that BET influencers like Ralph McDaniels were helping to set and stamp the latest trends. So we could see that the network would give us a direct hit with our target audience. We ran the numbers and figured out we could blast BET with a commercial for about $1 million. And in exchange, we'd get wall-to-wall play for about a year. Our spots would run 10, 15, 20 times a day, and each time out, we made an impression. The numbers weren't huge, but we were target marketing, reaching our exact demographic. If we spent that same $1 million on, say, two or three 30-second spots on Friends, our message would have been lost. That minute and a half of primetime advertising at $1 million would have been a waste, a memory. Yeah, we would have been seen by another 10 million sets of eyeballs, but it's not like they would have noticed. And they would have been the wrong sets of eyeballs for our brand, since a good chunk of that audience was a little outside our demographic. Our spots would have been lost in the clutter. And besides, if they were paying attention, these coffee-sipping Rachel and Chandler wannabes in the American heartland weren't running out to the mall to buy one of our hockey jerseys. So we would have overspent by a mile. That's the mistake a lot of companies make when they have money to burn. When you're making every dollar count, when it feels to you like it's coming straight out of your own pocket, you have to make better, smarter decisions. Another thing we had going for us, couldn't put a price on, was our cred. We were a black-owned business, and in our community, this was like a badge of honor. We wore it proudly, even when we took on our Samsung investors. We made sure that me and my partners, Carlton Brown, Keith Perrin, and J. Alexander Martin, remained the face of the brand, because we remained the heart and soul of the brand. After all, we were selling our designs, our vision. We just needed a little help from some folks who knew their way around the fashion business, some folks with pockets a little deeper than ours. We set it up so that outside money didn't change who we were, what we were about, and what we were about early on was damn near broke, so that mindset couldn't help but carry over into this new partnership. Look up when the world looks down. Read a lot of business books and you'll most likely come across a pretty standard piece of advice, telling you to zig while your competitors zag. It's become a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, meaning there's a lot of truth to it. Often, you'll do well to go against the grain, to look at what the marketplace is doing, and to go another way. It's how new trends emerge from the old ways of doing business. But what happens in an economic downturn? How do you keep from tanking when all around you there's chaos and uncertainty? When the power of broke has come to refer to the buying power of your customer or to a cash flow that threatens to dry up? Well, it helps to be in a kind of recession-proof industry, like restaurant services office supplies, or low-cost home furnishings, but it still doesn't hurt to keep zigging. During the recession of 2008, for example, Domino's Pizza saw an immediate drop in sales, although the company's internal market research suggested that the drop had more to do with the perceived change in the quality of the product than it did with the economy. So what did they do? They embarked on an ambitious television ad campaign, seeking consumer feedback and promising to change their pizza recipe based on the response. Out of that, they ran a follow-up campaign featuring the new recipe, which they began to roll out in stores, doubling their profit in the fourth quarter of 2009, with a sales increase to $23.6 million. Domino's found a way to win by inviting customers into the conversation, a great way to keep them in the mix in uncertain times, because now they can't help but feel a rooting interest in your success. Plus, folks need to eat, right? So they might as well eat with you. Or remember the Snuggie, the silly backwards blanket roll that became a late-night infomercial sensation? It also became the butt of a bunch of jokes by late-night comedians, but it sold a ton. And what a lot of people forget is that it came on the market late in 2008, during the worst of the recession. It was the perfect product for tough times because it didn't cost a whole lot and because it appealed to customers who were forced to stay home, curled up on the couch, watching a lot of television, since they couldn't afford to go out. Point is, it's tough to predict when the timing is right for a novelty item such as this one. But if you keep it real, stay true to your brand, and figure out how to tap into the mood of your customers, you'll give yourself an edge, no matter the state of the economy or how much cash you have in the bank. Look, there's no one way to keep your business humming in a down market. You can even find two competing companies in the same industry with entirely different strategies. Consider the case of Office Depot and Staples, the two giant players in the office products business. During the recession of 2000, each company set out to manage costs, clearly a defensive move in an economic downturn. Office Depot cut 6% of its workforce, but was unable to substantially reduce its operating costs. Perhaps as a result, growth fell from 19% to 8%. Staples, meanwhile, decided to close underperforming stores, but at the same time increased its workforce by 10%. Unlike Office Depot, they did manage to put the brakes on operating costs, and as the recession lifted, the company was more profitable than it had been going into the crisis. Why is it that some companies find a way to thrive during tough times while others can only struggle? According to a Harvard Business Review study on recession spending, innovative business leaders pushing through an economic downturn can help themselves by cutting costs and investing in growth. When times are broke, smart companies reduce costs by looking at ways to operate more efficiently while continuing to spend on marketing and on research and development. In some industries, it might even be a good time to acquire new assets. The cost cutting is necessary and can be looked on as a short-term move, but continued investment is also essential as a company looks ahead to an economic uptick that can set off another period of growth. Basically, when they're up against it, companies must face the same types of growing pains and worries as individuals. And here again, we see the power of broke in a full-on way. It helps to remember that. Ask with reason. Whether it's you who's broke or the times that are broke, it also helps to understand that nothing is going to be handed to you. And you can see this in force when you reach out to someone for an assist or for funding. The pitch is probably one of the most misunderstood parts of how business gets done. When you come from a place of broke, when you come from a place of need, it can actually get in the way of what you're trying to do.
Power fact. According to the University of New Hampshire Center for Venture Research, 67,000 angel investor deals were put together in 2013, totaling $24.8 billion. Now, of that number, only 4% involved startups run by women, and fewer than 1% involved minority-owned ventures. I learned this alarming statistic from my friend Mark Mathis. He's the managing director of the National Minority Angel Network. And what it tells us is that it's not just enough to ask for money. Too often, people don't just take the time to understand how venture capital actually works. They might have a great concept, a great idea for business, but if they're not positioned to take in the finance, if they haven't done their paperwork or even their homework, well, then a potential investor is just going to look elsewhere.
There's an art to a successful pitch, and the best way for me to demonstrate this is to show you what not to do in this situation. What happens a lot of the times is that people let their desire run interference. You know, their back is against the wall, they really need funding or resources or whatever it is, and they can only think about what's in it for them. That's a big mistake. When you're pitching, you should never lose sight of the other person's needs. You should think, what's in it for them? And not, what's in it for me? We hear it on Shark Tank all the time. We'll be visited on a set by entrepreneurs who need something from us, but they hardly ever think to tell us what they propose to do for us in exchange for our investment of time or money. Instead, they tell us about how their business has changed their life, or maybe what they expect in terms of future growth. The give back to us is never presented in any terms other than dollars and cents. Off the show, here's how it usually goes. Someone will reach out to me and say, Damon, I have this business. We did $1 million last year, but I like to grow it to 20 million. With your help, I think I can. All I need is access to your Rolodex, 5 to 10 hours a week of your time, and maybe you could let me shadow you a bit so I could learn from you. Whatever we make over that first million, we can split. So that could mean $3 or $4 million in your pocket. But there's also a social component to it. Whatever we make, we'll take a certain amount off the top and build wells in this village in Africa, where I've been spending a lot of time. They need clean drinking water. Oh, and while we're at it, I also want to save the seals, because they're endangered. On the surface, this might seem like a good deal all around, a reasonable pitch. But look closely and you'll see my point. My hopeful partner has only addressed his own needs here, not mine. $4 or $5 million? That's great. But what if I got plenty of money and my priority is spending more time with my children, who I hardly get to see? Only 5 or 10 hours of my time each week? That's great, but what if I'm already spread pretty thin and looking to cut back on my work time as it is? You want to shadow me? That's great, but what if I'm concerned about privacy and keeping my business relationships confidential? And what if I don't care to spend my time or money building wells in a village in Africa where you feel this special connection? What if I rather address a crisis in Trinidad, where my family is from? What if that's my priority? And seals? What if I happen to have a fine seal coat hanging in my closet that's one of my prized possessions, and saving muskrats is more my thing? I know this is an extreme example, but I'm out to emphasize the point, so I want to make sure I'm clear. All of these particulars about me, this person could have easily found them out beforehand. He just needed to do a little homework. A quick Google search might turn up a picture of me in that seal coat, a picture of me working with this community in Trinidad, an article talking about how important it is for me to carve out time with my kids. But that never happens, does it? So here's my advice to all you power brokers out there. Go ahead and ask for help. Go ahead and seek outside investors. Go ahead and find yourself a mentor, but broke shouldn't mean you always have your hand out. Go ahead and extend your helping hand to someone else instead. You might be surprised at the good things that come back to you in return. Be different. Mose Bowles, a passion for fashion. Mosiah Bridges and Tramika Morris, bowtie designer and middle school student, single mom and tireless supporter. Oh my goodness, I love this kid. Best Shark Tank pitch ever, ever, ever. And the way it played out, I had to convince this young man not to take any money from Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary, even though it was the only cash offer on the table. Here's the story. Mosiah Bridges was an 11-year-old kid from Memphis, Tennessee, who looked like a mini version of me when he showed up on the set dressed in a full-out suit and bow tie. His mom, Tramika Morris, even reminded me a whole lot of my own mother. just in the way she stood behind her son and tried to make his dreams a reality. It's because of her that Mo's dreams were within reach. Really, this kid had it going on. We clicked right away. He even called me out as his fashion role model. So that just made him look even better in my eyes. Got to be honest. Tramika accompanied Mo on the show, of course, and she told us Mo dressed in a suit and tie just to go riding on his bicycle. So it made sense that Mo's business, Mo's Bows, was a line of handcrafted bow ties he made himself with a little help from his mother and great-grandmother. It cost him about $6 in material and other hard costs to make each tie. And once he got good at sewing, measuring, and cutting, he could knock out a tie in about 25 minutes. Granny could get it done a little quicker, in about 15 minutes flat. Now, what struck me about Mo and his mom in their young business was how organic it was, and how much it reminded me of my own first steps in the fashion industry, sewing my own line of tie top hats at the kitchen table with my mom. Mo's business was also a bare bones operation. Each tie was lovingly and carefully made, basically because they were making these ties for Mo to wear. It was a full-on family affair, more than a full-on business. It started out, Mo was simply looking for something stylish to wear. His mom had a good job working for a retirement services company, but it was just the two of them, and there wasn't enough money to spend it on fine clothing. But Mo wasn't interested in any rough-and-tumble, cookie-cutter type threads. He didn't want to look like every other kid in the neighborhood. At 9 years old, he was already wearing his church clothes to school, but then he got to where he wanted to switch things up. He wanted to swap out those stuffy neckties for a snappy bow tie, but he couldn't find any kid-friendly styles his mom could afford. Imagine me getting him a $50 tie and then him going out and getting mustard on it, Tramika says. At the time, in and around Memphis, the only ties Mo could find were single-colored, pre-tied, boring. There was just red, black, blue. No fun colors. Nothing spoke to me, he says. Listen to the world around. Nothing spoke to Mosiah Bridges, except for a couple of sweet, soft voices telling him he could make a couple of ties for himself. One of those voices was his great-grandmother's, telling Mo she could help. Granny knew her way around the sewing machine, had been sewing professionally for over 50 years. Plus, she had a stash of loose materials and fabrics, so Mo could go hunting through her treasures and come up with some designs he liked, all without breaking the bank. The other voice was Tramika's. I wanted my son to grow up believing that he could do anything, she says. Whatever his hopes and dreams, I wanted him to know that I would help him find a way to make them come true, so I could only encourage him in this. Whatever the next step, whatever decisions we had to make, I kept telling him we can make it together. So that's how it all started. Just Mo, his grandmother, and his mother sitting around a table, sewing up a storm. But Mo would have never even gotten to this point if he hadn't been listening to his own heart. What do I mean by that? Well, let's accept that Mosiah Bridges is cut from a pretty unique piece of cloth. Sorry, couldn't help it. Far as I know, there aren't too many kids going to school in a suit and tie, unless it happens to be a school uniform and they've got no choice. But Mo liked to look good. I can relate to that. Everybody in town took notice of the way he dressed. Folks at church, in the grocery store, at school. His teachers especially. I can relate to that too. The other kids, they gave him a hard time at first, which was about what you'd expect from a bunch of 10-year-olds. Once, in the third grade, one teacher even got the idea to encourage all the boys in class to wear ties on Wednesdays, just so Mo wouldn't be so alone in this. But that didn't go over so well with the other kids. Nobody wants to be told what to wear, right? Mo understood that better than anybody. I mean, this was a kid who didn't even wear sneakers when he went outside to play with his friends. He had to have a certain boot, a certain dress shoe. Every day was Wednesday and Sunday for Mo, who always wanted to look his best. And once he started flashing Granny's sporty fabrics around town, other kids began to spark to them. The teasing and razzing began to fall away. Friends, neighbors, cousins, people started asking Mo where he got his ties, if he could maybe make one for them. And the business just kind of grew from there. I put business in quotes because it wasn't really a business just yet. Mostly, Mo was just giving these ties away. Sometimes he'd charge just a few dollars, maybe one or two, maybe five or ten. I'm afraid Mo wasn't much of a negotiator back then. He tended to take whatever was offered. Once, he traded a tie for a bag of chips in the lunchroom at school. Soon, Mo learned his way around a sewing machine. Figured if his granny could do it, he could pitch in. It looked easy enough, he says now, but it took him a while to get it down. His first couple of ties were crooked, slightly off, but the great thing about a bow tie is that once it's tied, you could kind of mask these mistakes. Plus, it was a pretty easy garment to master. Not a lot of difficult lines or unusual cuts. The perfect accessory item for a kid to cut his teeth on as a rookie tailor. Every night, Mo would find some time to work on a new tie, and he put each and every one in circulation. Every day at school, he'd trot out a different design, a whole new look. Every memorable occasion, he put on something special. This was his thing, his signature style, and after a while, someone asked for a very specific white tie, a particular fabric Mo couldn't find in Granny's stash.
Power fact. Elon Musk, co-founder of PayPal and the founder of Tesla, sold his first computer program for $500 and he was 12 years old. Listen, everybody has to start somewhere, but it's those running starts that get us where we're going even faster.
At this point, he sat down with his mother and figured out he would have to charge real money. For this one tie, at least. He would have to sharpen those negotiation skills and know his own value. Tough lessons for a kid to master, but Mo wasn't just a sharp dresser. He was sharp where it counted. It made no sense to go out and buy specific materials just to give away the tie or sell it for a few dollars, Tramika says. It's basic business, but I needed to help Mo figure this out. Together, they came up with the number. $20. Wasn't exactly the kind of number that would make Mo rich, because if you factored in the time and opportunity cost, he and his great-grandmother would barely be making minimum wage, but at least there was a small profit built into the model. Mo's first customer was happy with his first purchase, and here I put customer in quotes because the transaction started with the dude admiring one of Mo's ties. He wasn't seeking Mo out online or walking into a store looking for something in particular. A particular tie caught his eye. That's all it was, and he asked if Mo could do something similar. This was how most of Mo's first sales came about. He moved up the ladder at school until the older kids started making inquiries, all the way up to teenagers in town who wanted to look good. It was great when the older kids started asking about my ties, Mo says. Adults too. But the sizing got to be a problem. My ties really only fit kid size necks, which I learned were about 15 to 18 inches. Adult size ties were a little longer, up to about 22 inches. So we had to take some special orders. Then, a producer for the Steve Harvey show heard about this little kid in Memphis with the sartorial flair. And next thing Mo knew, he was on television, talking about his ties, his fashion sense, his growing business. Things were about to pop. Be ready for the floodgates to open. Before this first television appearance, Mo and his mom never even thought about advertising. They had as much business as they could handle, thank you very much. But that Steve Harvey spot generated a ton of attention. Orders started coming in, and other press inquiries too. Got to admit it, it was a great story. A little kid itching to become a mini fashion mogul, his single mom supporting him every which way. Next, a reporter from Oprah Winfrey's O magazine did a profile, and that generated another batch of attention. After that, Mo appeared on the Today Show, and by now the phone was ringing off the hook. So Mo and his mom hired two local women to help with the sewing. They drop off a bunch of fabrics at the beginning of the week and pick up the finished ties at the end of the week. They developed a website to help handle orders from around the country. Tramika left her job, and before she went out looking for a new one, she decided to devote her full-time attention to helping her son get his bow tie business off the ground. Mo's Bowls was getting bigger and bigger, busier and busier, and the business needed a guiding hand behind the scenes. Mo would be out in front, the face of the company, but Tramika would be watching the books, filling the orders, and handling all the press inquiries and public appearances. After another while, they decided to bump the price of a standard tie to $25. more for adult sizes or special orders. Soon, Mo started getting some local press as well, and by the time he was 10 years old, his ties were being sold in a half dozen specialty shops in and around Memphis. This is where Shark Tank came in. What a lot of folks don't realize is that our producers are always out there doing reality show version of casting. In the beginning, a lot of the entrepreneurs who pitched us their business ideas were coming to us. And that's still the way it happens for most of our pitches. Folks are lining up for their chance in the tank with us sharks, and that's great. But the reality of reality television is that we need to keep people's eyeballs glued to their screens. So from time to time, we go off in search of a compelling story that will fit in with our format. And this kid out of Tennessee was basically heaven sent from Central Casting. Mo's handmade tie business was just perfect for Shark Tank, clearly. Our producers knew what they were doing when they booked him on the show. But what the producers didn't know was exactly how Mo's segment would go. And it went off in a wild direction. For the purposes of this book, it offered a valuable lesson in the power of broke. The way it shook out, predictably, was that every shark on the panel that week was charmed by this dynamic little kid, wowed by what he'd accomplished. He came on the show looking fine in one of his signature ties, his mom at his side. I was taken in by the whole package. We all were. Mo's ties were sharp, classic, fun. And just as important, he was cute and confident. He even came out and said he was the MBT, the next big thing, which just about blew me away. I mean, for a little kid to talk in such big, bold strokes, it was a public relations dream. And the whole time, Tramika looked on, beaming with pride. And get this, she let her boy run the pitch. I thought that was just tremendous. Mo and Tramika were asking for an investment of $50,000 in exchange for 15% of the business. But I didn't want to see Mo give away such a big stake for funding I didn't think he and his mom really needed. The other sharks seemed to back off on doing the deal for the same reason. They also backed off because it was generally assumed that I was in the best position to help grow this little company. And I guess I was, but I couldn't bring myself to take a bite out of this kid's business the way we normally do on the show. Mark, Robert, and Barbara were all out, but Kevin seemed to want to move in for the kill. Once a shark, always a shark, right? Kevin said he smelled a royalty deal. He actually held up one of Mo's ties to his nose and started sniffing it, and it got my back up a little bit, the way he was looking to make money off this little mom-and-top business. A business that looked a whole lot like my business had looked back in the late 1980s. Kevin offered the full amount Mo and his mom were seeking, and he offered to waive the corresponding piece of the business. He didn't want any equity, he said, making it sound like he was being a good guy. Instead, he wanted a royalty of $3 per tie in exchange for his investment. An offer that might have seemed like a sweet deal to an unsophisticated business person, but the rest of us could smell it for what it was. So I tried to talk Mo and Tramika out of it. I didn't just talk. I gave a bit of a hard sell. I tried to persuade Mo that what he really needed was a mentor, someone in his corner to offer guidance and experience, to keep him from going into business with someone like Kevin O'Leary. Nothing against Kevin. Even though we clash on the show from time to time, he's a good person with a good heart, but he does tend to see the world through the dollar signs in his eyes. As my first piece of mentoring, I told Mo and Tramika a story from when I was just starting out. I was a little bit older than Mo, but I was still living at home with my mom, still scraping. When I needed a little bit of financing cushion, somebody offered me $10,000 for 40% of my business. At that time, my business was only a couple of hats, so of course I was tempted to grab at the deal. But something held me back. 10 years later, FUBU was worth $400 million, which would have made this investor's stake worth $160 million, all for a tiny little infusion of cash I turned out not to really need. I said, I'm glad I didn't take the money. I strongly suggest that you don't take on investors at this time. I counted myself in this group, said I didn't think most should take money from anyone. I said, in regards to a deal, I'm out. In regards to mentoring, I'm in. And don't do this deal. But Kevin kept pressing, and I could see that Mo and his mom were tempted to take his money. I could understand the temptation, of course. $50,000 is a lot of money, just like $10,000 was a lot of money back in the day, to me. And there was enough of a profit margin in the way Mo and Tamika had priced their ties that they could tell themselves they could afford to pay out $3 each time they made a sale. So I put it to them plain. I addressed my comments to Mo directly because I wanted to show him the respect he deserved, even though he was just a little kid. I wanted him to know that I took him seriously. I told Mo my offer to mentor him was only good if he didn't take Kevin's money. Why? Because as much as I liked this little kid, as much as I liked his mom, as much as I liked their chances for this little business to make some real noise, I didn't think I could work with folks who didn't take the very first piece of advice I offered when it was clear I had their best interest in mind. In the end, Mo and his mom passed on Kevin's offer and embraced the opportunity to work with me as Mo's mentor. But even here, Kevin would not let it go. He asked Mo to reconsider. He could see that the kid was stuck thinking about all that money Kevin was dangling in front of him, even though the cooler heads in the room were telling him to walk away from the offer. Finally, Tamika stepped in and put an end to the discussion. She said, "Mo's the CEO of Mo's Bowls, but I'm the CEO of Mo." And that was that. Let others guide you. Now, we've highlighted some other stories in this book where one of our power of brokers has benefited from the insights and experience of a key mentor. But since this was me rolling up my sleeves to help Mo and his mom, I want to spend a little time on the value of these relationships. In a lot of ways, the mentor-mentee relationship is the single most important relationship you can have in your business career. And it starts from a place of kindness, but it doesn't end there. Let's be clear. I offered to work with Mo for some selfish reasons. For one thing, it would be a way for me to revisit and hopefully correct some of the mistakes I might have made when I was just starting out. For another, it would force me to keep focused on the latest trends in the fashion and accessory industries, which of course would have some carryover benefit for my own business. And just being honest, there'd probably be some publicity that would come my way as a result. Mo's success would in some ways be mine as well. Ultimately, though, I was blessed to be in a position in my life and career to be able to extend a helping hand to this young man, and I believed it was my obligation and my honor to share in that blessing. And so I offered to help. No big thing, but at the same time, a very big deal. Just how big a deal? Well, take a look at the numbers. 75% of executives point to mentoring relationships as having played a key role in their careers. 71% of Fortune 500 companies have a formal mentoring program in place. Managerial productivity increases by as much as 88% when a mentoring relationship is involved. 95% of mentoring participants report that the experience motivated them to excellence. Every entrepreneur needs a mentor. Don't believe me? Check out these findings from a 2012 survey conducted by MicroMentor.org. A matching service that connects aspiring business folks with volunteer mentors in their fields. The study showed that people who participated in a mentoring relationship saw their revenues increase by an average of $47,000, or 106%. Those who did not participate saw their revenues go up only $6,600, or 14%. As long as I'm on it, this is why I organize what I call game-changer meetings in my office whenever I can fit them into my schedule. It's a chance for me to work one-on-one with folks who reach out to me because they've seen me on the show or come to one of my talks. I'll sit with them for up to an hour and go over whatever it is that's on their mind, on their plate. It's like a micro-mentoring session. I charge a fee for the session, but the money goes to charity. And in exchange, this person gets to pick my brain on their business, their goals, their personal finances. Folks are lining up to sit down with me, and I wish there was more room on my calendar to squeeze in some more sessions. But I love the way these entrepreneurs see me as the people's shark and seek out my opinion. It's an honor to be able to help them out, even in this small way. Another way I interact with aspiring entrepreneurs is through my entrepreneur roll call posts I regularly put out on social media. A lot of times, I'll be up at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, sorting through the day just ended, planning the day ahead. It's when I do my most creative thinking, and there are thousands of people just like me. How do I know? Because when I put out the roll call, I'll immediately hear back from hundreds and hundreds of night owls just like me. I ask them to tell me what they're up to, what they do, where they live. We get these great conversations going, and a lot of times, folks on the roll call get in touch with each other. Then, I'll hit them a couple of hours later with one of my rise and grind posts to start the day, and the conversation continues from there. Honor your vision. It's a little too early to quantify what kind of help I'll be to Mo and Tramika, but I'm committed to helping them realize the full potential of their business, and they are too. As I write this, Mo's Bowls is firing on all cylinders. The company has taken in $250,000 worth of business in the past 4 years, and Mo's Bow Ties are now being distributed in a small number of boutiques nationwide. They've yet to move into the big box stores, and I don't know that they ever will. But in the meantime, they've expanded their line of products to include pocket squares and t-shirts. Next, they hope to move into other accessory items like socks and belts. Granny has been retired from the business. Mo and his mom now employ several cutters and sewers full-time. Mo himself has stopped sewing and turned his focus to promoting the Mo's Bowls brand, running the business. Oh, and he's also going to school. Mo's goal these days is to become a fashion mogul by the age of 20. I love that he's thought this through. Love that he's come up with 20 as his make-or-break age. Love that his mom is so solidly at his side. But mostly, I love that I'll be along for the ride.
Mo's key shark point, adore what you do. When Mo talks about not being able to find a bow tie that speaks to him, I understand exactly what he means. With me, it was about my kicks. I had a sneaker collection that you just had to see to believe. And the colors had to match up with my shirt, my jacket, some other part of my wardrobe. Or, like, the whole thing just didn't come together. We used to call it a fit. Mo's cut the same exact way. The kid likes to look good, and he likes to help others look good as well. It's what drives him when he picks out his clothes each morning. And it's what drives him when he looks at new fabrics and designs for his business. The money doesn't seem to be at all important to him yet. You can see that in the fact that he used to actually give his ties away or trade them for a bag of chips. Do you really love what you do? Would you do it for free or even for a bag of chips? If not, then maybe you should think about doing something else. Sure, money and success can be powerful motivators. And for a lot of us, our bottom line is just our bottom line. But even a little guy like Mosiah Bridges knows that out of his joy in making these great ties, good things will certainly come. Tramika's key shark point, keep swimming. It's tough to say how motivated Mo would have been without a constant push from his mother on this. But to her great credit, it was a gentle push. She tried to let Mo set the pace to follow his lead on how much time and energy to put into their business. But she never lost sight of the fact that Mo was just a kid. He had other things on his mind. The business was important to him, but he also wanted to take time to spend with his friends, time to play video games, time to just chill. In all the startup scenarios that I've encountered, I imagine this is probably one of the toughest ones. A mother and son set out on an adventure of an exciting new business. It's just as tough on the parent as it is on the kid. But you know what? She made this business her focus because her son is her focus, just like my mother turned her full attention to me. Who's standing by you along your side as you go about your business?
Be nice. The power of humility. Tim Ferriss, author, motivational speaker, entrepreneur, angel investor. The power of broke doesn't recognize class or station or circumstance. It has nothing to do with privilege or access or resources. You can grow up in the Hamptons, go to a school like Princeton, make a bunch of solid connections, maybe even have a little money behind you, and still get stuck at the starting gate. That's the situation my friend Tim Ferriss found himself in when he was trying to publish his first book, The 4-Hour Workweek. Now, I should probably mention here that Tim grew up on the wrong side of the Hamptons tracks, in a nice enough neighborhood, but nothing like the swanky summer homes of the Summer Beach crowd. So don't go getting any ideas about any kind of cushy childhood. These days, folks know Tim as a successful entrepreneur, an angel investor,